Okay, Ken, you had such a good time last time. You're going to tee up again?
Agenda paper 3 discusses a submission about the periods of service to which an entity attributes benefit for a particular type of defined benefit plan. Paragraphs 5 to 6 describe and illustrate the terms of the defined benefit plan. Paragraphs 11 to 17 summarize the results of our outreach on this matter. Paragraphs 18 to 42 present our analysis of how the entity attributes benefit to periods of service, and paragraph 43 summarizes our conclusion. In our view, in the defined benefit plan illustrated in the paper, the entity attributes retirement benefit to each year from the age of 46 to the age of 62, or if employment commences on or after the age of 46, the benefit are to be attributed from the date that the entity first rendered service to the age of 62. And now I will direct you to question 1 on page 16 and ask whether you agree with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS standards.
Thanks, Ken. Who wants to talk about IAS 19? Jens, want to come in?
I'm still not in age to receive defined benefit. I'm happy to discuss and go first, and I'd like to raise a question with the staff. So you give me a really hard time with this submission, and I just need some help to understand whether we address the submission that was raised by the submitter. Because when I read the submission, and I try to read several times, my understanding is that the submitter has a different fact pattern in mind, rather the one that we are addressing in the paper. And I do think that the submitter, I think, believes that there is an obligation when the employee is hired, so from day one, based on a fact pattern that is different that we address in the paper. Albeit I acknowledge that the submission is a little bit counterintuitive because there's some conflicting sentences in the submission, but I'd like to understand the way of interpreting the submission. So if you could elaborate a little bit on the how you interpret that there is no, because a little bit comes as a surprise, there's a view A and a view B, and both indicate that the submitter believes that there is an obligation day one. And now we come up with a view C, where we conclude in the facts that there is no obligation.
Yeah, so maybe I can start on this one. So at least through the submission that we received, and then we had further exchanges with the submitter as well to better understand the fact pattern, because like you said, when we first read the submission, there were some aspects of it that we wanted to clarify, which we did. So our analysis is based on our understanding of the fact pattern. So that's what we described in the paper, and that's why we tried to hone out just the facts that were relevant to the question that was being asked. And obviously, when you see the submission, it refers to some other things as well. Like, for example, it refers to some termination benefits and et cetera, et cetera. But the focus of the question was very much around how this particular aspect, like the defined benefit plan aspect of the employee compensation works. So that's what we've tried to hone out. And in terms of your comment on where the submitter refers to the obligation from day one, that was more in the context of the different views that were expressed in the submission to say in reading IS 19, that was how they read IS 19 to understand, at least the proponents of the different views read IS 19 in that way to understand when the obligation arose and when the obligation ended. And we then did our own analysis based on the wording, and the analysis in our paper reflects where we as staff have landed up. So I'm not sure if Anne or Katrina, if you want to add anything to that as well.
No, I suppose I don't confirm, Javed, your thoughts, and maybe Jens, if it's helpful. I think, as I say, when we first got the submission, you know, we weren't clear on the exact facts, so we asked more questions. And it's only to say that the submission does talk in particular about sort of dismissal compensation as well as the retirement benefit. But first of all, when we, as I say, when we contacted the submitter, we understood they're asking just about the retirement benefit piece. And we also think that fits in with an IS-19 analysis, because any dismissal compensation would be a termination benefit and is treated separately and differently in IS-19. So at least when we understood the question, we felt we were both answering the question asked, and it was appropriate in an IS-19 context to focus on the retirement benefit.
Okay, me being a little bit uncomfortable is that I've never come across such a fact pattern as that we are addressing right now. So it could help if we say at least in our tentative agenda decision that we have put our analysis or concentrated in the analysis of a specific question that could be in a wider scenario of an agreement and concentrated only on some facts. But this is just my observation when I first read the paper. So thank you.
Thanks, Jens. Bertrand?
So I agree with the staff analysis based on the submission received. I think important to stress that they, to my understanding, at least they are three key elements: the fact that there is a cap, the fact that you need to get a benefit, you need to accumulate consecutively for 16 years of service, and the fact that it's the year of service before the retirement date. So there are really three very specific circumstances that are contained in the submission, and that apply specifically to the question received. You may find elsewhere similar types of plan paying a lump sum benefit after a certain period of service, but I think the analysis might be different if the fact pattern for those plans would be different. I suspect it would be on a plan by plan basis. And so, in brief, I agree with the staff analysis and with the staff conclusion as expressed in the paper and in the tentative agenda decision.
Thank you. Lisa?
Thanks, Sue. I had the same observation as Jens, but thanks, Javid, for that clarification. That was very helpful. And I would agree, based off the fact pattern in the staff paper, I would agree with the conclusions in the tentative decision. And I think the key element here is that when the employee becomes eligible for the benefit, it's not to that point in time that you would actually start accruing the cost for that. So I'm in agreement with that. Apologies for the phone.
It's all right. Brian?
So I relied on the description of the fact pattern in the agenda paper and in the draft agenda decision, and I agreed with the conclusions on each of the three approaches. The one I had to think the most about was the first approach, the one where you start to accrue from the beginning of service, and I found that I had to think a lot about when I thought the entity's constructive obligation really, really began. And I had some sympathy for the arguments in paragraph 38. The thing that ultimately, definitively, and very clearly kicked me out of view A was actually example 2, illustrating paragraph 73. So I found that if I just looked at paragraph 73, I could debate with myself when the constructive obligation kicks in. But example 2 seems to have a fairly similar fact pattern where you have to have consecutive periods of service from a date in the future. So for me, example 2 meant that I couldn't accept view A. And obviously this is an example that is part of the standard itself. It's not an illustrative example, it's an authoritative example. And for that reason, I agreed with the staff conclusions on all of the three views. And without getting ahead of myself, I did wonder, because example 2 was so important to me, if there should perhaps be a reference to example 2 in the agenda decision. But overall, I relied on the fact pattern in the staff paper, and I agreed with the conclusions in the staff paper.
Thanks, Brian. Karsten.
Yes, thanks. Similar to Brian, I was also, focusing very much on example two in paragraph 73, which is about, paragraph 73 talks about, actually the paragraph itself talks about the date that you stop recognition of the attribution of the benefits. And I felt, overall, I felt that the analysis in the paper seems to rely, heavily on the, first of all, on the benefit formula, the exact details of the benefit formula, and specifically the fact that the retirement benefit is calculated using only the number of consecutive years immediately before retirement. And it also seems to focus very much on paragraph 72 and 73, right? So I was actually wondering whether perhaps, not enough emphasis is given to the words in paragraph 70. I understand that this would be on the basis that paragraph 72 and 73 would be the more specific and, thus the more relevant guidance. I do, however, think that paragraph 70 is the key principle for the allocation that should be carefully considered. And now that paragraph states that, attribution of benefits should start from the date the services, when services by the employees first leads to benefits. And it then goes on to say that this applies regardless of whether or not the benefits are conditional on future employee service. So obviously, the key question here is at what date do services by the employee first lead to benefits under the plan, ignoring that these benefits may be conditional on further service. Now, paragraph 6 of the staff paper describes in detail the benefit formula and states that the amount of benefits is capped at 16 years of service. It also includes a condition of future service, which is that the employee must be still at employment at the date of retirement. So I would actually view this as a condition to provide further services up until retirement, which I think paragraph 70 explicitly says should be ignored for the purpose of determining the starting date for the attribution of benefits. So I think the part of the benefit formula that says that the benefit is calculated using only the last consecutive years immediately before retirement is essentially no different to a formula wording that says that the benefit is calculated as the number of years of employment with a cap of 16 years and a condition for future services that is to remain in employment up until retirement age. So essentially, I understand the staff's logic. I can see where this is getting at. I also think that's consistent probably with, example two in paragraph 73, as Brian pointed out. However, based on the principle in paragraph 70, which, specifically says you ignore the future service condition, I'm more inclined to think that attribution of benefits should start from the date the employee joins the entity. So personally, I'm not convinced that the words in IS 19 are sufficiently clear to conclude that only view C is an acceptable reading of the standard.
Thanks, Karsten. Staff, does anybody want to respond to that so people can think about it when they're formulating their responses, or should I just keep going with the interpretation members?
Maybe I'll just come in very briefly just to say very quickly that, yes, so I agree with you, Karsten. The paragraph 70 does set out that you start accruing benefits from the day when service first leads to benefit. But I think the key still remains that you need to assess when service first leads to benefit. So in other words, when the entity has an obligation. And I think it's the words that follow in paragraph 71 to 74 that then explain how you assess when the obligation arises, and that's then what our analysis then follows through. So just thought I'd just clarify that as to where we were coming from, if that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. And to add maybe, Jawad, what the way I see things is, and to put you on your proposals for the committee member to commence, the way I see things is that actually the paragraphs that are subsequent to paragraph 70 clarifies when you apply when you when you stick to the service period to assess the length over which you, you straight line the expense, the service cost, but specifies explicitly, to my understanding at least, that effectively you need absolutely to assess the obligations that derives from the plan scheme or from the scheme, and it's not service, it's not related. The obligations do not derive from the service periods. They derive from really the obligations that are entailed within the scheme. And I think that is exactly what paragraph 72 and 73 precise in the specific fact pattern that was analyzed by the staff. Hence, in this specific fact pattern, I don't see how it is possible to reach the conclusion view A. I think it's impossible in this specific fact pattern because of the cap, because of the cumulative aspects. There is a cap, there is cumulative service period over 16 years, and that is the last 16 years of service just before retirement. So the accumulation of the three, then you need to assess not the service period to account for the expense, but you need to assess the acquisition of the rights, let's put it that way, by the beneficiaries. So it's more like a legal consideration, so as to what is really the trigger events for this acquisition of the legal rights that will go to the beneficiaries.
Thank you. Guy.
I agree with the technical analysis in the paper. You know, I can certainly understand why, you know, at first blush, someone might be more comfortable with the result of a view A or a view B, given that it's leads to an earlier, a higher accrual, and at least in the view A type approach, a more consistent accrual over the entire service life of the particular employee. And so I can understand intuitively why that might strike somebody as the accounting answer. And I can see someone sort of emphasizing, you know, certain aspects of paragraph 70 to 74 to help rationalize that outcome. However, I think the technical analysis in the TAD that focuses on paragraph 70A about commencing when service first leads to benefits under the plan. The pointing to the sentence in paragraph 71 that says you attribute benefits to periods in which the obligation to provide post-employment benefits arises, and then the discussion in paragraph 72 that is quite clear as to, you know, when that obligation arises, I think together, you know, at least in my mind, is quite persuasive as to what the proper technical analysis is here. So, you know, I think there are schemes out there where that are similar to this arrangement, where entities have not necessarily applied a view C. They've been more in a view A type thought process for more of the sort of intuitive type reasons I described earlier. But having said that, I think the proper technical analysis is as has been laid out in the paper. So I'm in agreement with where the staff has landed on this one.
Jim.
I also agree with the staff analysis as well as the conclusion, and I think the fact pattern is unique. That's why some people are thinking about the backwards counting on the vesting date. It's a little bit weird, but I think that's the entity made this way. They construct this the contracts the way that leads us to count the vesting days backwards. So it's not the analysis nor the the principles are wrong. I think that's the unique fact pattern that gives us the answer. That's the way I look at this case. So just I agree with the staff analysis as well as the conclusion. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Yes, I also want to say I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. I think this agenda decision make it clear that the incurrence of obligation is the key for the recognition of retirement benefit. And I think that is the correct reading of the standards. So I should say I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion.
Thank you. Sophie.
I also agree with the conclusion of the staff analysis. I think that the requirements of IS-19 are clear. Maybe when reading paragraph 670 in itself, we could conclude that view A could work. However, with examples provided in 72 and 73, I think that it's clear that we cannot apply approach the view A. So I fully concur with the analysis of the staff, but I wonder if maybe we could simplify we could have a more simple submission without specifying that the condition should be on the last 16 years, because I don't think that this condition has an effect. To the extent that we have a cap of 16 years, whatever the period, I think the treatment would be the same, because you would consider only the last 16 years before the retirement date. So maybe in order not to narrow the example and to make broader the conclusion, we could maybe adjust the submission. So you see my point.
Just my initial reaction to that, maybe I think two important facts for us. I think there were two very important facts. One was that the service had to be consecutive. So if someone left and joined again, they would lose any service that they had accumulated. I think that was quite critical to answer. And also the fact that there was indeed a cap, because if there was no cap, then I don't know what the conclusion might have been in that case. Like, we never looked. So I think I would be nervous about trying to simplify in a way that kind of took away one of these two conditions. But if you have any option, if you have any suggestions, we'd be open to considering those.
No, but my question is, if there was not the condition of the 16 years just before the retirement date, why to add that? Is it important in the treatment? I'm not sure it is, because it is different from the initial submission, in fact.
In example 72 or 73, I don't remember exactly, there are other examples that mention the first years of service rather than the last years of service. So, and potentially you get to different conclusions there. I don't know if Jawad did something eventually you wanted to mention also.
Yeah, no, I think that covers what I was going to say as well. I think we are just basing it on the facts that were given, and we've not assessed other facts patterns, so I would be nervous about changing the fact pattern that we have currently. Because I think all the facts are quite critical to get us to the conclusion.
John?
So I also agree with the staff's analysis and the conclusion on view C. I guess the question I had, which I think has maybe been somewhat answered is through the discussion, is if I'm reading correctly the staff paper, the analysis on paragraph 16 and 17, it seems that the majority of respondents actually gravitated towards view A or B and not view C. So what concerned me a bit was, well, it seems like generally we are all gravitating towards view C, why didn't the other respondents? And is it because maybe it's because this is a bit of an unusual fact pattern where it's based on the last years of service, amount and accumulating benefit beginning with your first year of service. So it's a bit of a maybe unusual fact pattern, or if there's something else. So I was curious whether the staff had any further insight as to why, first of all, am I reading it correctly? Did the majority of respondents gravitate towards one of the other views? And if so, do they have any insight as to why, beyond what's in the paper?
Javan, did you want to respond?
Yeah, maybe I can just start on that. So I think like Guy said, it was probably a situation where intuitively the answer almost seems to be, when you think about the plan intuitively, almost the answer seems to be like a view A, where it seems like it's natural to spread it out over the life of the employee service. So that's probably the natural starting point. And I think in terms of view B, the attraction there is it kind of follows, because the table says for 1 year of service you get this, and up to 16 years of service you get this, it seems to in a way to follow what the table lays out. So at least that was our understanding of where people were starting from in terms of this analysis. It was just when we queried the words a lot more closely and looked at the examples and everything that are in the standard that we then were able to get to where we got to. So hopefully that helps answer a bit of your question.
It does. Employee benefit items always worry me a bit because they can be so unique to jurisdiction and to company. So I'm a little bit, there's a part of me which has a bit of reluctance on this item just because it is so fact pattern specific, that any example is perhaps dangerous to analogize to because it could be very different based on very, very narrow facts. But having said that, given the facts as laid out in the paper, I agree with the conclusion on view C. So that's helpful. Thank you.
I mean, maybe, John, I was just going to add to that, John, for the reasons you give. I think it's hard. You know, we obviously send out outreach requests and we try to make them as detailed as we can. But I imagine that, you know, some of the responses we get, by the way, the responses are fantastically helpful to our outreach requests. But it's sometimes perhaps difficult to know if the responses are, you know, addressing, in this case, a defined benefit plan with exactly the same facts as we had in the submission. And I think to your point, there could be defined benefit plans that are very similar in many ways, but maybe just, you know, one key condition is different, and that might be why, for example, in the outreach responses, we're getting told that for similar plans, often people reach a view A, but perhaps there is actually, that's reflecting the fact that there is just, you know, differing terms and conditions in there that naturally and correctly, you know, leads to a different view.
Jens, did you want to come back in?
Yes, but I would like to give to Mary first hand, because Mary has something to add to the fact pattern I may have, then I can withdraw my comment. So Mary can come first, then I pick up. Is this okay?
Sure. Mary, do you want to come in?
Okay. Thanks. I was just going back because there were some questions about whether the staff had modified the fact pattern in the submission, and Javed, I think, explained why he was hesitant to remove any of the characteristics. I wanted to kind of reinforce this point because I think while this requirement to work the last 16 years is not explicit in the original submission, if you go to the follow-up that the staff did some follow-up looking at page 31 of the paper with the submitter to confirm some of the specifics of the fact pattern. And I think it's a combination of the response to question one, whether the employee is still employed at the time of retirement, and the response to question two, when the submitter confirmed that the service calculated is based only on the second hiring and not the first, that I think the staff has translated those answers into the correct fact pattern in terms of characteristic of the plan. And at least to me, when reading the staff's analysis, that characteristic of you have to be employed at the time you're eligible for retirement and you do not get any credit for, let's say, service when you left before being rehired, is critical to fitting in with the fact pattern in the example following paragraph 72. So I agree with the staff's suggestion that you not modify the fact pattern, but I wanted to assure interpretation committee members that I thought that the facts as set out about the terms of the plan are consistent with the original submission as clarified by the submitter.
Thanks, Mary. Jens, did you want to comment?
I think it was very helpful to let Mary go first. And even though I'm a little bit biased towards the view, and I struggle with the question that Carsten also raised, whether and when there is an obligation, I agree with the analysis for this specific fact pattern and want to echo what John has said, that a slight deviation of the fact pattern would come to a totally different outcome. And so, therefore, I'd like to echo that we should not modify the fact pattern, and it's about when and what kind of obligation exists. And for this fact pattern, I can agree with the staff conclusion. Thank you.
Thanks, Jens. Goro.
Yes, thank you. I also agree with the staff's analysis and conclusion, but I have very similar concern as John raised, that I have found that the paragraph 16, that the majority of the respondents have Bill A. So that I'm a little bit concerned about that there might be a confusion if we publish this agenda decision. But anyway, this very very specific fact pattern that the analysis and logic of the staff is very convincing. So I do support that the staff's analysis and conclusion. And I have a question that since there are so many respondents with view A, are these people forced to restate their financial statements if this agenda decision is published?
I'll make a couple of comments on that, if that's all right. Firstly, I think it's going to depend on how similar people's fact patterns are to what's in the agenda decision, assuming mm-hmm. it is final, right? Because I think mm-hmm. quite a few people have pointed out that it seems to be a very specific fact pattern, so that may mean that there may be as many mm-hmm. directly affected by it. Mm-hmm. But I think the perhaps more important generic point is that when we recently updated the due process handbook, we've made a specific reference in there to the fact that people do need to apply relevant agenda decisions to be in accordance mm-hmm. with IFRS standards, but that we believe that agenda decisions provide new insights. And so because it's mm-hmm. new information, something they didn't have in mm-hmm. the past, that means that typically it wouldn't result in the need to restate. Mm-hmm. They'd move, change sort of going forward only.
Thank you.
Is that helpful?
Thank you.
Rika. Yes, very helpful. Yeah, thank you. I'm just considering Goro's question as well. And I think how summarize the fact pattern the staff did seems a very collection of good essays of what we need to consider specifically about this paper. And but we normally familiar with, the pension plan that we are usually familiar is normally the length of cumulative employee service years beyond the 60 years of the service are normally considered when calculating the benefit of the employee provided to the other retirement benefit. So that means those service years should be counting when calculating the benefit and obligation that will be borne by entity. But this case is a very unique case. and different from the those normal familiar type of the pension plan. So I think that point is critically important within the fact pattern of this paper.
I agree. Okay, I think now we are ready to ask the committee question two. So whether you agree with the staff's recommendation not to add a standard setting project to the work plan. Could I get a show of hands? Okay. Okay, so we're down one on the show of hands, I think, and Brian is also in agreement, Petrina?
Yeah, so that should be 12 then.
Great. Okay, now moving to the wording of the agenda decision. Does anybody, so I heard somebody suggesting that adding an explicit reference to example two, given it's part of the requirements as opposed to just an illustrative example, was one suggestion I think was made early on. Guy, would you like to make some comments?
May seem minor, but a reason anyway. In the fact pattern where we refer to retirement age of 62, consecutive years of employee service immediately before retirement, et cetera. We seem to flip back between retirement age, retirement date, and actual retirement. And I think we're clear in the fact pattern, or sorry, in the analysis in the TAD that there would be no attribution to any years beyond 62. So that either means the employee is required to retire at age 62, or if they don't, they can't accumulate any more benefit after age 62. So for example, if you had an employee start at age 55, and by the time they got to 62, they only had 7 years of service, the way we've analyzed the fact pattern is if they weren't required to retire at 62, but kept working beyond 62, they still could not accrue any more benefit after age 62. And so I thought we needed to be slightly more precise in the fact pattern for that conclusion to hold, that there would never be any attribution of benefit after the age of 62. And so I was wondering aloud whether in the first paragraph B in the first page of the agenda decision at the end where we say number of consecutive years of service, you know, if we said at retirement age, and then in item D in the next section of the fact pattern where we say right at the end employee service immediately before retirement, you know, we might say retirement age there, and then it struck me that may help that the follow-on conclusion that there would never be any benefit accruing after age 62, because otherwise it wasn't entirely clear from the way we had described the fact pattern, at least in my reading of it.
Okay, I can see Javid nodding in response to your comments, Guy. Brian, yes, it was you that made the example two comment. Did you want to elaborate?
Yes, if that would be helpful. I mean, firstly, I thought Guy's comments were good. The interesting thing, example two for me, is that it's about the fact pattern where somebody provides 20 years service before the age of 55 and then gets a benefit. And specifics of this example two is that in advance of that last 20 years of service, they can join and leave, and that has no impact on the benefit. And that seems so closely analogous to the fact pattern here, where until you're in the last 16 years, you can join and leave. But once you're within the last 16 years, if you leave, that's it. And that, for me, was the reason why example two seemed particularly relevant to this fact pattern and the acceptability of view A. So that's my specific reason for suggesting a explicit reference to example two within paragraph 73.
Okay, again, Javid's nodding. I don't see anybody else wanting to comment. So with that, can I get a show of hands on who supports the tentative agenda decision with the suggestions made by Guy and the addition of the reference to example two? Brian's telling me by chat box that he agrees. So that's everyone except one, I think.
Yeah, that's 12 then.
Right, good. Okay, so now we can move on to supply chain financing, can we, Petrina?
Yes.
Thank you, Ken and Javid, for that. Okay, who's helping us with supply chain financing?
It's Craig.
Craig. Can I see Craig?
Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I can hear you, but I can't see you. There you are. Okay, good. All right, thank you.
Okay. So moving on to agenda paper four in that case. So in June, the committee published a tentative agenda decision about supply chain financing arrangements and in particular, reverse factoring arrangements. The committee received 22 letters on its tentative agenda decision. And the majority of the respondents agreed with the committee's decision to publish an agenda decision. Some of the respondents had comments on the committee's technical analysis and or the wording of the agenda decision that the committee should not publish an agenda decision and instead to undertake standard setting. So the question of whether to proceed with publishing an agenda decision is discussed in paragraphs 16 to 25 of the paper, and we recommend finalising the agenda decision. Paragraphs 26 to 40 contain a summary of our analysis on our summary of the comments and our analysis on those comments, even on the committee's technical analysis, and in paragraphs 41 to 58 contain a summary and our analysis of the comments on the wording of the agenda decision. And then appendix A to the paper includes our recommended changes to the tentative agenda decision in response to those comments. So before I move on to the questions for the committee, I wanted to just mention the ideas for standard setting to improve disclosures about this particular type of arrangement that the committee discussed in June. Some respondents to the committee's tentative agenda decision commented on those ideas, and this is discussed in paragraphs 62 to 70 of the paper. And we plan to bring a summary of all of these comments plus the committee's June discussion to a future board meeting. So the question for the committee today is on page 21 of the paper. And that's where the committee agrees with our recommendation to finalise the agenda decision, as explained in paragraph 71 of the paper.
Okay, and just to be clear, I think it is clear, but just to be, make sure it's clear, if we finalise the tentative agenda decision, it doesn't preclude a decision to do some specific disclosure changes subsequently, right? Yeah. Okay, good. Right. Who would like to comment on the question on page 21? Any comments on the analysis and the proposed changes to this agenda decision? Guy.
I was quite happy with the way the paper stepped through the comments that came through the comment letters and the proposed approach to those comments, and in particular the few changes to the wording in the agenda decision, I all thought were good and helpful. Maybe the only maybe two constructive comments I might add, it relates to the sharing of feedback to the board as part of their decision about whether to embark on a narrow scope standing setting project in addition to finalizing this agenda decision, and if so, what the scope of that is. It struck me that it some of that feedback might go beyond just the disclosure comments that have been raised, in particular. How to determine whether a cash flow exists. Some of the comments around that might be useful to include in the feedback provided to the board. That's not necessarily a narrow scope standard setting project that is exclusive to these arrangements, but it is interesting feedback for the board to consider. But the only other observation I had on that is, you know, I think given the number of commenters that, you know, I think are continuing to encourage consideration of a narrow scope standard setting project in addition to finalizing the agenda decision, you know, given the number of commenters in that camp, I think it may be useful to reiterate in the IFRIC update, you know, that we intend to share that feedback for the board's consideration. So, you know, essentially, you know, almost repeating what we said in the original IFRIC update about narrow scope standard setting, and, you know, articulating again that we intend to, you know, share that feedback to the board for their decision making. But beyond those two comments you know, possible further standard setting, I thought the way the comments had been analyzed and concluded upon was appropriate.
Thank you. Carsten.
Thanks. So I also think the comments have been well addressed by the staff. So I do agree with the staff's analysis overall. And there isn't also with the proposed changes to the wording in the agenda decision, I would also agree with those. But I do have two points that I would like to raise for discussion around, you know, potential further improvements in the wording of the agenda decisions, if others agree with that. The first one is around the staff analysis in paragraph 36, you know, derecognition and the implications for presentations. So I realize this wording is not in the agenda decision itself, but you know, at least my view personally would be that, and I'm happy to elaborate further on that, but my view would be that if you get to derecognition of a trade, you know, of the original liability and recognize a new financial liability towards the bank, I personally think it's not acceptable to present this, to continue to present this as trade payables. So the agenda decision doesn't really talk about that, but I'm slightly worried that, you know, I think at least in my experience, you know, there's currently broad consensus that in case the original trade liability is derecognized and a new liability towards the bank is recognized, that this has to be presented separately from trade payables, which, you know, the agenda decision is not precluding. But I think it may be helpful to, you know, if others were to agree with that. I think this is, you know, certainly widely accepted by stakeholders at the moment. So, you know, I'm worried that if we are now suggesting otherwise, we may be creating a risk of, you know, increasing rather than decreasing diversity in the application of IFRS. The other comment I would have is the analysis around, you know, how to deal with the presentation in the cash flow statement. The staff analysis says in, paragraph 48, or excuse me, paragraph 50, that on the existence of cash flows, that IS7 provides no further requirements to assist an entity in determining whether a cash flow exists. I certainly agree with that. And so I don't think we can say much more. But I wonder whether it might be helpful to just say this, you know, that there is no further guidance in IS7 to determine whether cash flow exists, because I'm slightly worried that, you know, people may read the agenda decision as, you know, requiring a net presentation. So either an operating cash outflow or financing cash outflow. I agree with this staff's technical analysis, but I'm just worried that people may read the agenda decision as as that way, rather than, you know, saying that there is some judgment around, or at least IS7 does not provide any guidance on how to assess whether a cash flow exists. So these are the two recommendations I would have for the improvement of the agenda decisions, if others agree.
Thanks, Carsten. Just on the first one, So at the moment, the agenda decision, if I'm looking in the right place, basically says that if there is derecognition, you need to determine how to present. So it's a relatively neutral statement.
Yeah.
Which I quite like, just because of the variety of schemes out there. Is that where you're suggesting a more specific direction?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. You know, I think, you know, typically, you know, you can get to derecognition two ways, right? The first one is a legal extinguishment, and the other one is that you derecognize based on, you know, the requirements in IFRS 9, paragraph 332, you know, that the terms are substantially different. So, you know, I'm worried that, you know, if there's a legal extinguishment, I think the old liability doesn't exist anymore, and so you... I think it doesn't meet the definition of a trade payable. And if it's derecognized based on the notion that it's substantially different, then I struggle to see, you know, a liability that is substantially different, that it would not be sufficiently different to require separate presentation under IS1. And finally, I think that's widely accepted, at least in my experience. I think everybody's doing that. So that's why I'm just worried that we may create diversity if we don't clarify this.
Okay. And I guess we just have to balance it with making sure that the agenda doesn't change or add to requirements in IFRS standards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let others comment on that. Bob.
Thanks, Sue. I agree with finalizing the agenda decision and also agree with staff presenting to the board a paper for some future standard setting. I think our agenda decision is helpful in explaining some of the requirements of IS1 and definition of a trade payable within IS37. I think where the agenda decision addresses the statement of financial position, I think we will see some diversity because the other payable that's noted in there is dependent on working capital, and working capital is not defined. And so I think we're going to get some diverse views, and that may be something to put in the paper for the board to look at. I think for, you know, Karsten raises a very good point. For example, if you were to have a derecognition event and then recognize a new liability, I think that some people will look to the definition of their own definition of working capital and believe that it isn't other payable and not debt. I'm personally in favor, like Karsten, of debt, but I don't believe that there's enough guidance in here for our committee to be able to say definitively that would have to be debt. So I do think there's potential for diversity in views that, you know, the board might want to take a look at. On the disclosures, I think they're very helpful. Can the board do more? I think that's possible, but I think the question that the board is going to have to face is scope. Because I think there are many programs that are very similar to these reverse financing arrangements, and that's going to be a difficult issue to deal with. Mm-hmm. On the agenda itself, the only comment I have is I do not like the word, the change the staff. I've done all the changes were really good, except for I did not like the change of changing substantively to sufficiently. I know sufficiently is used in paragraph 57 of IS1. I think it's used incorrectly there. I think it's used incorrectly here. Sufficiently means enough or a required amount. I don't think that's what we mean in here. We mean in here a comparison. So I think substantively, or if you don't like that, significantly would be a much better term. That's all I had.
Thanks, Bob. Okay, Jens.
Yeah, I'm glad that I stood up, Bob, because I can echo what he has just said. I agree that the agenda decision is well drafted and it's balanced with the comments we received. And my only remark, I acknowledge what Karsten said, that there is an issue with regard to derecognition and re-recognition. However, I don't think that we as committee can address this. This should or could go to the board for further discussion, but from our perspective, I think that's as much as we can do to keep it neutral. And in addition to what Bob just said, I do like substantially more than sufficiently. I don't think that sufficiently is addressing what we want to say.
Thanks, Jens. Okay. Sorry. John.
Yes, I very much agree with the comments from both Bob and Jens, both in terms of what I think we're limited in our ability to do as the Interpretations Committee, but also regarding the use of the word sufficiently. I think substantially would be more appropriate, but I don't think using sufficiently is an appropriate word in this context. The only other point I would add is just it's in response to one of the staff's analysis on whether the working capital movements would typically be classified as operating versus investing. Speaking from an individual who works in a capital intensive industry, there's a significant amount of payables and receivables, payables that can flow through investing activities, whether it's through the capitalization of property, plant, and equipment or the capitalization of development costs. So I wouldn't want to necessarily conclude that it's a limited situation or a rare situation where you could have payables and receivables flowing through investing activities, because I think it actually could be quite pervasive in certain industries.
Thanks, John. Bertrand.
Like many, I agree with the agenda decision and with the staff reporting to the ISB, and the fact to have that as a specific comment in the freak update, maybe reiterate the comments we had in the June IFREC update relating to a comment for the board, a specific comment for the bill for the board. I have just one comment relating to the wording within the draft agenda decision, and that is in the last paragraph relating to presentation in the statement of financial position. I think that the two examples of factors that are presented there would in some circumstances lead to think that the liability needs to be reclassified as a borrowing. So I would have stated that, and notably also because then it would make a clear link between the paragraphs relating to the presentation in the statement of financial position within the agenda decision and the presentation in the statement of cash flows, because as currently worded, the draft agenda decision is very clear on the way how to account in the statement of cash flows or how to compute figures in the statement of cash flows, but is not as prescriptive in the statement of financial position. So I totally acknowledge the fact that it reflects the way IS7 and IS1 are respectively worded. I totally appreciate that, and I agree. But in this last paragraph in the presentation, the statement of financial position, we are just mentioning examples. So it could be useful to state, for instance, the committee observed that an entity assessing whether to present liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement separately as borrowing might consider factors including, for example, which would probably also help resolve one of Carsten's comments on probably the diversity in practice subsequently. But my main concern is really to make it a bit clearer that there is effectively a consistency between the presentation in the statement of financial position and in the statement of cash flow.
Okay, thank you, Bertrand. Brian.
Yeah, thank you. Similar to others, I like the agenda decision a lot. I think the introduction, the publication of this explanatory material would be a good and useful thing. It would make me feel good about what I've done this year if this goes out following a board discussion. I have a couple of comments on the drafting, which include responses to some of the things that other committee members have said. If I run through them, I'm going to go through them, the points in the order in which they appear in the draft agenda decision. On page 23 in the discussion of the statement of financial position, the first bullet point that's labelled A on page 23 that begins at the payables. I know, based on the previous discussion, why this bullet point is about other payables. But I wonder, given a bit of time to think about this, I wonder if that bullet point could be specifically about liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring. So it could say, for example, liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement as trade and other payables only when those liabilities have a similar nature and function. And I did email through some suggested wording. It just seems that with the passage of time, I think that bullet could be made more precise and helpful if it were to be specifically about liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement being presented as trade and other payables only if that condition's met. So that's my first suggestion. My second comment, when we get into the derecognition section, I heard what Carsten said. I heard the responses from a few other people. I guess my personal position is that I am comfortable with the existing wording in that section, and I'm not sure if we can go further to make too explicit a link between the outcome of the derecognition test and the subsequent classification. I have two more points to go. My next one, on page 24, is really, really small, and it's just about the addition of the word typically in the paragraph beginning an entity that has entered. I agree with adding typically. I just think it's in the wrong place, because I think an entity always has to determine how to classify its cash flows, but they are typically cash flows from operating or financing. So again, that's just a small amendment. My remaining two points are both on this page, and they're both more significant. So I heard Bertrand's comment in this paragraph, and I know, based on the previous discussion, that he believes that the classification in the statement of financial position is a really important driver of the classification in the statement of cash flows. And I think he would probably like to strengthen this paragraph, if anything. I come from the opposite side on this. I think that the current standards do not have a cohesiveness principle. I think that the cash flows do need to reflect the nature of the cash flows. I actually came to this meeting with a wording designed to soften that paragraph. I hear that Bertrand and maybe others want to strengthen it. As a compromise, I'd rather leave it as it is. I would struggle with any strengthening of the link between the balance sheet and the statement of cash flows. And then my last comment, and then I promise it's my last comment, and then I'm finished. And it touches on the two sentences at the bottom of page 24, which I think are going to be important to what a lot of us are going to have to deal with in practice about what this agenda decision is really saying on gross versus net cash flows. So firstly, there are two sentences, the one beginning consequently in the next sentence, that are balancing statements, aren't they? The first one is saying that if there's a cash inflow and outflow, then you present this in the cash flow statement. And then the second sentence says if there are no cash flows, then you do something else. And I wondered if it would be helpful to align the wording of those two sentences, so that the first sentence says, consequently, if a cash inflow and cash outflow occur, and then the second sentence would say, if no cash inflow or outflow occur for the entity, just so that the two sentences, just so that you can't slip a bit of paper between the two sentences and argue that there's a debate to be had about why there's different wording in the two of them. For me, I think if those two sentences are the precise converses of each other, then that tees up the debate that we're going to have in practice about existence. Like Carsten, I wondered whether we'd want to say in an agenda decision that the IS7 doesn't provide any guidance on existence. I backed off that personally when I thought about it, because I worried that having that kind of negative sentence could imply it's a free-for-all. You know, there's no guidance on existence, so it's a free-for-all. I'd rather make those two sentences the converse of each other. So although we haven't completely answered the question, we repackaged it such that the question everybody has to discuss now is whether or not a cash inflow and cash outflow occur. So I'm sorry I talked for a long time. It's just I like the agenda decision and wanted to suggest those specific changes.
Well, committee, you should not feel, you know, the weight on your shoulders that if you agree to issue the agenda decision, you're going to make Brian's year. It's within your power. Young Su.
Hey, thank you. I also want to say that, you know, I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion, and I also agree with finalizing the agenda decision. Nonetheless, I have one comment about what Carsten said before. Carsten said that our agenda decision increases diversity instead of decrease diversity. And I agree with that. Our agenda decision does not make any specific decision. Instead, we say several options available for trade receivable, I mean payables. That is why, you know, the agenda decision will increase diversity. I agree with that. But I think that is why we need standard setting. And standard setting, I think, is very important. You know, so that, you know, I want to say a little bit about the standard setting that the board has to consider. The first thing I want to say is that the board has to be careful about disclosure. You know, disclosure is important, and we have to provide some information and disclosure needed by the investor. But, you know, as I mentioned in the last meeting, too much information is not always good. So we have to think about the balance between, you know, the quality and quantity in determining what kind of disclosure we require for the reverse factoring arrangement. And the second one, I want to echo Bob. Bob said the scope of the standard setting is important, and I agree with that. You know, we concentrate only on the reverse factoring arrangement in our agenda decision, but there could be many other types of, you know, supply chain financing arrangement in general. So we have to include those things in the standard setting. And finally, income statement aspects should also be included in the standard setting. You know, there could be some, you know, expenses like processing fees or service fees related with providing the reverse factoring arrangement. And I don't know whether they are financing costs or non-financing costs. And I also wonder whether these are operating expenses or non-operating expenses. So I think that the board has to include not only the balance sheet and then the cash flow statement that we focused in the agenda decision, but also the income statement in the standard setting. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, Young Su. Goro.
Okay, thank you. Like others, I agree with the staff analysis and recommendation to finalize the agenda decision with some important modifications, and also to recommend the board to develop the new requirements to disclose regarding these disclosures. And this agenda is, this submission is come from the users. And when we discussed this topic in June, I was not very sure that the agenda decision would be enough to encourage the preparers to provide users of financial statements with more relevant and sufficient information. However, we have already decided to recommend the board to develop the disclosure requirements on the reverse factoring arrangements to require preparers more specific and relevant information on the supply chain financing arrangements. For now, I believe this revised agenda decision would provide the basis of the more consistent and the relevant disclosure among the preparers who uses reverse factoring arrangement as their important financing sources. The agenda decision would be a bridge between the situation where the presentation and disclosure on the reverse factoring arrangements are inconsistent and are not relevant enough to the users, and to the more consistent and relevant presentation and the disclosure regime under the new disclosure requirements developed in the near future. So I support the staff recommendation to finalize the agenda decision with proposed modification on the wording. And regarding that, some people suggest that the diversity in the practice may occur with this agenda decision. But I think that the current problem is that the not enough and relevant information is provided. So I think that this agenda decision will help the preparers to provide more relevant and the consistent information to financial statement users. Thank you.
Thank you, Gaurav. Marie.
Thank you. We really appreciate this agenda decision as well, and we think it's an important sort of first step regarding this type of scheme which are developing. And so if the agenda decision can be published in December, I think it will be great, because it will help for the closing that just coming. I would like to echo what some of the members said regarding the fact that it should be useful just to re-mention in the agenda decision that the staff will report to the EISB. As we think, as I said, it's a first step, but there are still some concern, and so it's important that the board can appreciate what to do, and obviously we'll appreciate if the board can do something on this topic, just to also give some conclusion on the different issue we still have.
Thanks, Marie. Carsten.
Yeah, thanks. So I just commenting again on this point about substantially versus sufficiently. I normally wouldn't get too excited about it, but I just want to highlight that, you know, substantially different is a term that's used in IFRS 9 paragraph 332 and also the related application guidance. So I think we talk about derecognition in the next paragraph. So, you know, I think we should be clear whether we mean to talk about derecognition. If we don't mean to talk about derecognition, I think we should avoid the term substantially different, because otherwise I think it's just confusing, right? So I think either we should say substantially different, full stop, without the rest of the sentence, or we should stick with the previous wording of sufficiently different, which is in line with IS1 requirements.
Or whether we could even do something more neutral, just off the top of my head, because I had the same sort of thought about substantially passing through my head during this discussion, which is whether we could do something more neutral. Petrina, maybe you could mull over it while the last few people speak, to say whether the difference in the terms of the liabilities of the part of the arrangements and the entity's trade payables warrant separate presentation or something like that, you know, that sort of removes those the magnitude point.
Yeah.
Because that's, we're trying to make a more generic point. That's just a thought to try and, because I can sort of see why people don't necessarily like sufficiently, but words like substantial and significant and things all have baggage attached to them in terms of sort of magnitude. So maybe you could mull over that, staff. Sorry to do that to you. Lisa.
Yeah, just to comment on that exact point that both Kirsten and Sue just made there, I thought that the word substantially, that really indicates something significant. So I was much more comfortable with the word sufficiently, or if we find some other more neutral wording, I think that would be more appropriate. And then going to Carsten's comments on the derecognition point, I think that the wording that as it's already in the tentative decision is supportive of that. It just, you know, makes you go through to do the analysis and make that determination. I wasn't 100%, Carsten, following exactly the wording you were proposing, but it almost sounded like it was being a bit more restrictive and pushing pushing preparers into saying that automatically it would have to go into a financial liability. So I think the wording as it is now would be is appropriate.
Thanks, Lisa. Jim?
I support the staff analysis and pretty much the wording of the proposed agenda decision. I think the wording pretty much reflected what we have discussed last time on this subject matter. And knowing that reverse factoring could be very different in practice, and all the concerns people addressed a minute earlier. And knowing that we cannot just mention all these different patterns and the concerns, just giving this fact pattern and the guidelines, particularly on the disclosure, should be helpful to the field so that we will see what other fact patterns or concerns may appear later. But right now, if we extend our paper or our issues too much, it will be too broad of a task for us. So I think we limit ourselves to the fact pattern, and to the extent we discuss right now should be good enough. So I think with some direct wording change, as people mentioned, I'm fine with that. Otherwise, I think I'm good with the current. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Yang Su, did you want to come back in?
Yes. Yes, I want to make a very short comment on what Goro said. Goro said disclosure is important for the analyst, for the information users. I agree with that. But I want to say that classification of payables is very important for the companies also. The classification determines the working capital of the companies and also the current ratio. And also the changes the credit ratings and the interest rates of the companies. And also, for example, in Korea, companies cannot sometimes apply for the government projects only because they cannot satisfy a certain level of working capital or current ratios. So I want to say that classification is very, very important in this case also, besides disclosure.
Thank you very much, Young Su. And I think that's the end of that.